Welcome to PM Lessons Learned, a podcast for project managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Increase your PM knowledge, build business relationships, increase your effectiveness, increase your marketability, gain professional support. Join our group and take part in our conference calls. Details at pmlessonslearned.com.
Hello, and welcome to the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP study group conference call and podcast. This is podcast number 88. We are recording this session on the 3rd of December, 2009, and we are now totally focused on version 4 of the PMBOK guide. My name is Dana Safford. I'll be your host for the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP study group conference calls. I've been a PMP since version 2 of the PMBOK, and I'm also a Microsoft Certified Systems Engineer and have two tests to go to finish my ITIL version 3 expert certification. I have over 25 years of management experience, project management experience in the IT industry. I work for Hewlett-Packard as a complex problem manager, which means I take a very complex situation that is affecting an HP customer's enterprise production environment, and I manage a project with a virtual technical team that quickly resolve this issue. So remember, you don't have to have the term project manager in your job title to actually be a project manager. Our presenter for this session is me. And then our topic is project selection methods, according to version 4 of the PMBOK. And the short abstract is as follows. Version 4 of the PMBOK guide to Version 4 of the guide to product management book of knowledge, or the PMBOK, only minimally touches on the methods used to select projects. However, the exam still contains project selection questions. This month's PMP study group call focuses on those project selection techniques. There are changes to PMBOK from version 3 in this area, but not too many. Dana Safford, BMP, will provide insight and practical examples for everything you need to know for building your critical knowledge mass to pass the PMP exam on the first attempt. If you haven't already downloaded a PDF copy of today's presentation, please do so. We distribute the file through Yahoo Groups. We have a group called PM Lessons Learned. If you need the steps to sign up for Yahoo Groups, then go to pmlessonslearned.com, and in the left-hand column, you'll see a pointer to Files and Presentations. If you are already a member at Yahoo Groups, once you are logged into the Yahoo Groups PM Lessons Learned page, click the Files link in the left-hand column, and then select Materials for the Monthly PM Exam Study Group. From there, it is roughly the ninth file down as we are recording this session. The file name is PMLL Project Selection Methods 3 December 09. It's a PDF file. The title of the file is PMLL Project Selection Methods December 3, 09. Okay. So you'll see the files from the last couple of months in there as well, and an updated version of the version 4 brain dump there as well. If you look in the past monthly PMP study group call folder, you'll also find about a year's worth of files. But be very careful with those files, because even though pretty much all of them are based on version 3 of the PMBOK guide, and you should remember that there's only about roughly 30% difference from version 3 to version 4, and that's pretty much all in the processes and their ITTOs, which we're really not going to talk about tonight. But on those other files, you need to pay attention to some of the processing, so that you don't get confused if you go into those older files. And finally, this is the monthly PM Lessons Learned PMP study group call and podcast. If you are on a shorter time scale and are willing to make a commitment to actively participate and take turns presenting study group materials, our weekly virtual PMP study group might be right for you. So for more information on that, send an email to pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com. Okay, so we are pmlessonslearned.com, project managers helping project managers to make a difference. Thank you in advance for all the people who are live on this call right now, and for those listening to the podcast. And with that, we'll get into the presentation. Okay, I'm going to start on slide one. In slide one, we have some of the bit of trivia that we tend to go through here. I'll remind you that this is the first Thursday of the month, the first Thursday of December 2009. So this is the monthly PMP study group call. On the second Thursday of each month, we have a PM Lessons Learned PM Job Shop conference call, and we're at the same number at the same time. So if you are in transition or want to receive some more information about job shopping and jobs and careers and things like that, you are going to that call on the second Thursday of the month is a place to be. On the third Thursday of the month, we have our PM Lessons Learned conference call. This is where we do presentations from authors of books and folks with a lot of experience in the project management world, and they'll talk about some topic of project management that will help you in doing your job. So if you have some time, it's the same time, same number for that one as well. Dial in and participate. Henry would love to have you on that call as well. You can listen to all of the previous calls by the phone or by download, or download the podcast at pmlessonslearned.com. There's instructions in the left-hand column to do all of that. And if you're not already a member of our Yahoo group, that's where all the files live, as I mentioned. The group name is PM Lessons Learned. Go there and you can grab all the files and all the other things that are involved with PM Lessons Learned. I'm going to move to slide 2. Now, and talk about some of the call norms. This is an interactive call, and we want you all to participate. I've muted all the lines for the interactive folks. If you want to ask a question, you'll need to do a *6 and unmute your phone. And then once you're asked, you get my attention, and we'll bandy about for a little while. Once you have I have answered your question, do another *6 to mute your line again, and then we'll keep on going here. So don't be afraid to ask any questions. Just get my attention and let me know what your name is as we're working through things. Moving to slide 3. On slide 3, we talk about our email address. If you have any questions at all about the PM Lessons Learned group and what we do and things along those lines, send an email to pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com and ask your question. And finally, some of the legalese we have to worry about here. And as I go through this presentation, I really hope you're going to use this as additional study material. So there's a lot more words than there are graphics in these slides, because graphics are a little hard to study from, and words are easier to study from if you don't have the accompanying audio. But hopefully you have both, and you'll be able to go along just fine with both of those. You'll find that much of the material that I'm going to go over today comes from a study guide series put out by John Wiley and Sons. It's the Project Management Professional Exam Study Guide, the 5th edition by Kim Heldman. This is the edition that is strictly version 4 of the PMBOK focused. There are earlier versions that have version 3. I have a version 3 focused. This is version 4 focused. The ISBN number is there, so that if you want to grab that, you certainly can. And I use all the material here with the permission of the author. I'm a registered instructor with the John Wiley Company for their CYBEX series. So with that, we move to slide 5, and we start to get into some of the meat here. We're going to be talking about project selection methods, and today is the 3rd of December, 2009. Moving to slide 4, we talk about project selection. It really varies by your organization, by the level of formality that your organization uses or dictates or demands. In some groups, it is led by a program office. In other companies, it is not. Or other civic groups, there's no program office. It's done by how much money you have. So there are a lot of times financial hurdles involved in selecting products, because you only get so much money, so much time, whatever the case may be, and you have to pick projects that are going to meet your needs for the financial financial hurdles that you have to worry about. But there also may be technical hurdles as well. It depends on what your project is and what you're trying to do. Moving on to slide 7, we look at how projects come about. This will definitely be on the test. That's what that big red dot up by the title of the slide is for. When you see those, that means this is material that will most likely will be on the test for sure, because we've checked with folks who have taken the test recently, and those things do tend to appear. And various needs and demands, as you can see on the slide here. If there might be a market need for something that this project can provide. It could be a business need that a going concern sees an opportunity for some additional line of business or whatever. could be a customer request. You've got a batch of customers or batch of users or participants, whatever the case may be, and they need something from you, and it's going to require a project in order to for you to develop whatever service or whatever thing that your users are looking for, your customers are looking for. Or maybe there's a technological advance that has rendered whatever you currently offer as a service or as a product somewhat obsolete, and you have to update, if you will, because of a technological advance. There's also legal requirements. As laws change, perhaps something that you are doing might be out of code now, and you have to do something in order to bring your product, your service, up to some legal requirements. And then finally, there might be a social need. Perhaps there is something wrong in the world someplace that you just feel you have to take care of, and you need to do a project in order to come up with a solution for that particular need. It'll vary depending upon what you're doing, what organization you are in, but those are the ones that perhaps the social need and the human benefits outweigh some of the costs and things along those lines. So there's a real good strong need to do some additional project in order to fulfill that need. So those are the main things, these needs and demands that cause projects to be formed and undertaken. Moving on to slide 8. There's also something called feasibility studies, and that comes into play when perhaps you've got something in mind, you have something in mind that you want to try to do or your company does, and you don't know whether it's feasible or not. So now you're going to take it a step further, and you're going to determine whether a project is viable or not. You need to determine the probability of that project succeeding. And that'll probably mean you're going to put together some type of study that will include financials, that will include technology, that will include expected results and expected costs and things along those lines to determine just what it might take to undertake your particular project that you're trying to sell to management or sell to your organization, determine whether it's feasible or not. And they can be done as separate projects in and of themselves, as a matter of fact, or sub-projects, or maybe as the first phase of a project. It all depends on your organization, how they work that out. When you don't know the outcome of the study, maybe it's better to do it as a separate project than if it turns out, well, it's not feasible to do this, then you haven't expended a whole lot of project management time, expertise, whatever, into this thing. It's been a short little mini project to do with the feasibility, and you say, okay, we're done, and hopefully it'll be less costly to do that because you're not invoking a whole lot of infrastructure in order to do your feasibility study. And another important point is if you're doing a feasibility study, you probably do not want the people doing that you think will be doing the final project to work on a feasibility study, because there may be some bias there. They may want the work, so they're going to potentially slant the feasibility study toward themselves so that this project will be done. And so just be aware of those types of things for the test. Moving on to slide 9. And then there are projects done by steering committee. These are these strategic planning things that a lot of companies or a lot of organizations have. You basically you pull a group of senior managers together or mid-level managers, and these people represent some function of the organization, however your organization is structured. And what these folks do is they will perhaps look at a laundry list or a checklist of projects that they maybe sent out a solicitation for various projects because they know they're going to have X amount of money in the next fiscal year or calendar year or whatever the cycle that this organization uses, and they're soliciting projects. And you've hopefully already done your feasibility or your business plan or whatever else, your business requirement statement, and then you're going to present to them. And you may be one of a dozen or two dozen folks presenting projects to the steering committee. And what they will do is review all of those proposals and try to prioritize and select those projects and determine which ones they're going to do. If they know they have a certain bucket of money, perhaps they'll, once they're done doing their prioritization, they'll be able to draw a line when they run out of money, or perhaps they've got some other selection method that we'll get into in a little bit. But what they'll do is they'll review all of those proposals and come up with the ones and choose the ones that they feel meet the needs of the organization or of the company, whatever it takes to be. And then everything's documented and reported on in a project list. And if a project for some reason is canceled during the year, maybe another one of those projects that were initially on the original solicited list might be now called up to go try out and actually be implemented. So keeping the list documented and handy is a good thing if you happen to work in a project management office or for the exam or whatever. You know, you want to keep a note on what projects were proposed so that if you have to backfill with another project, you'll already have the list right there. Now, as you submit project ideas, they should be in writing for sure. I don't think you really want to do an oral one because then you're going to lose all of the detail. So they really should be in writing, should have a high-level overview of goals, deliverables, business justification, maybe some requirement statements, things along those lines, timing, timelines, things along those lines, what the organization will gain from this, especially if it's a social type of thing going on, list of functional areas that are affected by the project, and maybe a cost-benefit analysis of some type of business analysis that will show why this project should be chosen over some other project. So you're going to be selling your project based on its financials. Because you have to face it that most companies are going to look to invest their money in where they can make the most return. So you have to set up your proposal in those same methods, same manner, and we'll be going over those methods in a couple of slides from now. Moving on to slide 10. There's also projects by default, because there are some organizations that have a bucket of money and they just freely choose. Whoever comes forward with some idea, some project, they can work on it start right away. What I'm trying to say here, it's within their own budget. They don't have to go through any steering committee or anything along those lines. It's just as long as it falls within the budgetary guidelines, they're all set to go. So there may be no financial or technical hurdles that they have to go through. It's a matter of quick assessment of need. They see something they have to fill right away, and they develop an ad hoc project in order to fill that need. I've seen that in several organizations. So it's much less formal, much less documentation going on, but it's still a project because it still has all the definitions of a project. It's just easier to justify if you happen to be in that arena. Moving on to slide 11. So let's now begin to talk about some of the project selection methods that we'll be going over tonight. And they consist of mathematical models and benefit measurement methods. Now, mathematical models you won't have to worry too much about for the test, as they are far beyond the scope of what the exam can cope with. These tend to be higher level, very detailed methodologies for programming and things along those lines, linear programming, dynamic programming, multi-objective programming, things along those lines that are well beyond the scope of the test. You just have to know for the test that mathematical models can be used and what some of those mathematical models are. And the other way to determine a project or select a project is by doing some benefit measurement models. And these are the things that you're used to seeing, I'm sure. The cost-benefit analysis or benefit-cost analysis is one way to do that. There are scoring models. Then there's things called payback periods, discounted cash flows, net present value, and internal rate of return. And the rest of the session is going to be talking about all of these methods in the bottom of slide 11 here. I'm going to move on to slide 12, and we get into some of the details here. First is with the cost-benefit analysis. With the cost-benefit analysis, what you're doing is you're comparing whatever the cost is to produce a product or service, whatever it happens to be, and it's usually in terms of dollars spent to develop the product. And you're comparing that with what it is you're going to be saving or generating once the project is implemented. So you're either going to sell something, you're going to get revenue, or you're going to be saving a cost somewhere along the line. It might cost you, we'll make up some numbers, $100,000 per month to follow some manufacturing process or something before the project is implemented, and after the project is implemented, it's only going to cost you $50,000 a month. So there's a $50,000 a month savings or cash flow that you can attribute to your project, and you want to capture that and apply that against the financials for your project. So what we have to do is compare cost-benefit type of thing. And a sound project is one where the cost to implement the project is a lot less than the financial benefits. So there's a net gain there is what that points out. And as far as the organization's decision, some companies are very comfortable with a small margin, while others want a much larger margin. You're going to have to pay attention to whatever your company likes. If your company or organization only likes to see large margin projects, then it probably doesn't make much sense. Once you run some numbers, you've only got like a 2 or 3% margin. Chances are it's not going to fly. So you'll have to pay attention to how your organization does things and then go accordingly. A note here is that sometimes cost-benefit analysis are also known as benefit-cost analyses. The test pretty much says cost-benefit, doesn't do the other way around, but the techniques are the same, it's just a name flip. People tend to use benefit-cost sometimes if they're trying to do a positive connotation, but it really doesn't matter. 80% of the population will say cost-benefit, not benefit-cost, but it's the same thing. Moving on to slide 13, and we get a little bit more about cost-benefit analysis here. As you're examining the cost during this thing, make sure you include all of the costs, not just the development costs. There are things around marketing that you have to pay attention to. There's operational support costs that you need to pay attention to. If this project is going to be around for, say, 5 years, and you know it's going to cost you X amount per year to maintain that, then you have to include that into your costs. So make sure that you do that. And the note you see there, if projects of significant cost or complexity will probably want to use more than one benefit methodology. So as you'll see in a little while, once we do some get down in the brass tacks of selecting projects, you're going to do a couple of different calculations. You don't just go by one, because sometimes there's a tie. And if there's a tie, well, which one do you choose? If you have other metrics to use, then you can carry on and still make a decision. So make sure you calculate a few of the metrics or all of the metrics, as you'll see in a little bit, so that whatever body is choosing your project will have more to go on. And then if there's a go-no-go decision, you might be chosen over another because you've done a more detailed analysis. You never know what could happen. And we have to keep in mind the final point down there, that selection methods can sometimes be very subjective. So sometimes it doesn't matter what your financials are. If your CEO says, I want to do this, then it's a done deal. You're gonna go through it, and even if it has atrocious financials, if it's the CEO's pet project, it's going to get done, and that's the way life goes. And if you're on that project, fantastic, but don't mess it up. if you're in that boat, if not, you carry on with whatever your next proposal is going to be. Moving on to slide 14, as we go through the next type of metric, we have a weighted scoring model, and the way I'll spend some time working through this example here, and we'll see how weighted scoring models operate. When you do weighted scoring models, what you want to do is come up with a half a dozen different criteria. You can do more if you want, but having for the five or six is a good thing to do. Trying to save space on a slide, we're using three criteria. The first is profit potential. you see in the left-hand column, then marketability, and then ease to produce or support. And what you want to do is for each one of those criteria, you want to give them a weight. Normally, a 5 is that's the most important criteria you want to pay attention to. A 3 in the middle, a 1 not so much. You could have you could have 2s and 4s in there as well, but some way to weight how ardently you want to apply that particular criteria. And then what you do is once you have the weights worked out, then you look at however many projects you're trying to compare. For this example, we're comparing 3 projects. And what you do is you notice in column in the first column under Project A, you see a score. So for Project A, it's scored a 5, and a 5 is the highest. So Project A has the highest profit potential. Has a very high profit potential. Let's put it that way. Project A has a very high profit potential. Its marketability is rated a 4, so it's going to be relatively easy to market, and its ease to produce and support is a 4, so it's relatively easy to produce and market as well. And then we look at the same column for Project B, and for Project B, it's a 5 for profit potential. But the Project B is not so easy to market and not so easy to produce. So they get 3s. Those two criteria get 3s. And we look at Project C, same column for Project C, the score column. We see that its profit potential is not so high as the first two projects, but it's got a really high marketability. It's got a 4 for marketability, so it's going to be easy to market, but not so easy to produce. It's only a 2 for producibility. And if you have more projects, you just continue that process till you have everything scored as for each of the criteria. And then it's strictly a multiplication game from that point on. You take the score for that particular criteria for that particular project. So if we look at the Project A, we see that the score for profit potential was a 5. We see the weight for profit potential is a 5. A 5 times 5 is 25, and that's why you see a 25 in Project A total, and then Project A total column. And then you go down to the next row, and you do the math there. 4 times 3 is 12. And then you go for marketability, and you go down to the next column. 4 times 1 is 4. And if you have more criteria, you keep on going all the way down. And then at the very bottom, you add up all the weighted scores. And you do that for every single project. And then the easy answer is you pick the one with the highest score. So for this example, 41 is the highest score for Project A. So just from a weighted scoring model, you would select Project A. Now, does anybody have any questions on that? And if you want to ask a question, do a *6 to unmute. And I'll pause for a second. And hearing nothing, I'll move on. And we'll go to slide 15. Now we're going to get into some heavier numbers here as we talk about cash flow analysis. Cash flow analysis pays attention to, obviously, cash and money, and it also pays attention on when the money comes in, when you have to spend it, and when you are receiving money in as well. And there's 3 different metrics we're going to be looking at when we talk about cash flow. The very first one is payback period. This will be on the test, just like the scoring model will probably be on the test as well. Payback period is defined as the length of time required to regain all your investments. So if you've spent X amount of money to develop a project, how long is it going to take, either in revenue or in savings, to offset that same amount? And it's basically initial investment minus enough either quarterly, monthly, or yearly cash flows, depending upon how you count it, by either revenue or savings, to bring the difference to zero. And that's payback period. So let's look at the example here. We have an initial investment of $200,000. We use dollars since I'm sitting here in America. We'll use dollars. I just came back from China. I could have used RMB as well, but we're going to use dollars in this case. And so that's our initial investment. You pretty much always consider the investment done in what we'll call time zero, in the very first time period. So there's no discounting of initial investment 99.9% of the time. For the test, there certainly will be no discounting of the initial investment. It's whatever they tell you it is. Now, you might have to add up little bits and pieces from the scenario to come up with what the initial investment is, but you will eventually have an initial investment sum that you're paying attention to. And then you work on your cash flows. And as I mentioned, it's going to be either in revenue or savings. Sometimes the question is very nice and just says the cash flows are, and you can just pick them right off. Sometimes you have to calculate those as well. For this example right here, what we're going to show is we're going to have a cash flow of $25,000 per quarter, and it's four quarters in a year. So we have an annual cash flow of $100,000. And we're going to do that, keep that up going for 2 years. So in year one and in year two, we're going to have a $100,000 cash flow. And then in year three, the cash flow bumps up to $50,000 per quarter for four quarters, or $200,000 for the annual cash flow. And so we now have our initial investment of $200,000, and we have our cash flows of $100,000 a year for the first 2 years and $200,000 a year for the third year. Okay, now we work down to the math in the middle of the slide here. We take our initial investment of $200,000, and we subtract the first year's expected inflows, which is $100,000. So we subtract $200,000, and we subtract $100,000 from $200,000. We have $100,000 left. And now we apply the second year's inflows, which we know is also $100,000. $100,000 minus $100,000 is zero. So we just have determined that we pay back in 2 years. Okay, now carrying on into the third year, we know we have $50,000 per quarter coming in. We don't care. It makes no difference because we've already paid back. As soon as we go down to zero, it doesn't matter what the cash flows are from that point on. Payback period only looks at the time period required to bring the initial investment down to zero, and if there's a huge increase in the inflows, it just does not matter. We don't do time value of money here either. So if we're talking about cash flows 4 and 5 years out, you do not have to discount them. That's one thing to pay attention to for the test. The test will probably show you maybe $200,000 a year for one answer and maybe $200,000 in year three discounted, which is just going to be, it's going to be something less than $200,000. And once you apply that, you don't have to do that for payback. Payback value never considers time value of money. The payback period doesn't. Okay, any questions on that one before we move on? *6 to unmute if you have a question. Hearing nothing, I'll move on to slide 16. And with slide 16, now we're going to get into the time value of money. And you will have time value of money questions on the test. But the good news is you've got a four-function calculator there on the one of the upper buttons, and then toward the upper corners of the screen is a calculator button. You hit that, and you've got a four-function calculator that will allow you to do this type of calculations. You'll need probably some scratch paper in order to help you out, but they give you the scratch paper or scratch slides. Hopefully, they give you paper. If you're one of those test centers that tries to give you acetate and dry erase markers to take the test, try to wear some. What I tell people when I do the brain dump session or the test prep session, wear something nice, long sleeve, so it'll be obvious that if they give you the acetate and the dry erase markers, you're going to get your shirt all messy. So please, can I use paper and pencil? That's another little tip. And a way to find out is if you live close enough to your test center, go visit them one day and watch them hand out stuff to the test takers and see what they give them. If they give them paper, you're golden. If they give them the transparencies and dry erase markers, you wear that good shirt and play I don't want to get my shirt messy. Because you certainly, as you do some of this math, you're going to want to not be very messy, and you want to be able to go over it again later on. You don't want to have to erase things as you go. Okay, so let's start at the top of the slide here for time value of money. We're talking about discounted cash flows. First, we're going to talk about future value. And I think everyone is aware of future value. That basically is money that you received in the future is worth less than money received today. There's a formula there that you use in order to calculate it. And that it's future value, that's what the FV is equal to present value times the quantity of 1 plus I, which is the interest rate, raised to the number of raised to the power, which is the number of years in the calculation. And you're going to know if there's one, if there's 3, 4, 5 years in a calculation. I doubt very much if they're going to do anything longer than 5 years on this. Typically, it's normally 3 years that the that they do in the test. You're not spending too much time in the calculations. So in English, the formula says the future value of money of the investment equals the present value times 1 plus the interest rate raised to the number of time periods. And this is not very difficult to do. The next major bullet there, I show you how to work through a quick example. In that, if I borrow $2,000 from you and agree to pay you 5% interest per year, and I'm going to pay you back totally in one lump sum in 3 years. So we're not doing monthly payments. We're doing one annual payment, and then we'll pay you back in 3 years. You see the formula there. Its future value is equal to $2,000 times, in parentheses, 1.05, because it's 1 plus the interest rate. The interest rate is 5%, and 5% we know is 0.05. So it's 1.05 raised to the third power. Now, the chances are the calculator on the test is not going to have powers in it, but we keep the number low because all you have to do is multiply it out. 1.05 to the third power is nothing but 1.05 times 1.05 times 1.05. You just do it three times. And that you can certainly do on the calculator, the 3-4 function calculator that is in the test engine. And then once you do that out, you find that is equal to 1.157 mumble for the rest of it. And you just multiply that by $2,000. Then you find that the future value of that lump sum of cash that you have to pay back that you'll receive, or you'll, depending on your point of view, that in 3 years is $2,315.25. So that's the future value of $2,000 at 5% per year in 3 years. Okay? And that's all there is to it. And if you have a question that involves this on the test, that's how you work through it. Excuse me. And any questions on that, I'll pause, do a *6 if anybody has a question on that. All right. With hearing nothing, I'm going to move on to the next slide. And now we're going to get into a little bit more with time value of money. This time we're going to be doing present value as part of discounted cash flow. Now we're talking about future cash sums coming in. And what we're doing here is comparing the value of future cash flows to in today's terms, in terms of today's dollars. And you know, you find this going on a lot as we do project selection and in a lot of other things. And not even for project selection. Anybody watches television here in America, I'm not sure if you see the same things in Japan or in Singapore, as we have people on the phone bridge tonight from Japan and Singapore, where if you are in an accident, you have a structured settlement. Say you're injured and you are going to be receiving, say, $1,000 a month for the next 10 years. So you're going to be, you could say that's $12,000 a year for 10 years or $120,000, but it really isn't worth $120,000 to you before the time, because of the time value of money that is really worth something less. So there are companies out there that will take your structured settlement and they will offer you something less than that $120,000 if you sign over your structured settlement. And how do they figure out how much they're going to give you? Using the present value formula that we're about to go over. You know, they'll know what your monthly inflows are or your annual inflows are. They know how much settlement is they know what their hurdle rate that they want to meet. And if they can convince you to sign over your structured settlement, so you get cash up front as opposed to over 10 years, and they make some money doing it, that's how they make the money. So you'll see a lot in America, you see a lot of those types of TV commercials for structured settlements, and this is what they do. The formula that you see is in the second bullet. It's basically you're calculating the present value, and to do that, you have to take the future value of each of the periods involved, and you're going to divide that by 1 plus the interest rate raised to however many periods the period number that is. Okay? So let's go through this a little bit more. I mean, it's basically the inverse of the future value formula we just talked about. So let's ask a question, and we're going to use the same, basically the inverse of the previous example. So we have to ask a question: what is $2,315.25 received 3 years from now worth, given a 5% interest rate? So when you do these future value things, you have to know the amount, and you have to know the interest rate, and you have to know the period, how many periods there are. And that question provides all of those. We know the value is $2,315.25. We know the period is 3 years, and we know the interest rate is 5%. So we're going to apply the formula. So present value is equal to the 2315.25 over 1 plus 0.05 raised to the third power. And just like on the first slide, don't worry about those powers. That's just 1.05 times 1.05 times 1.05. And you're going to multiply all that together and come up with that same 1.157625. But this time you're going to divide it into the amount that you're going to be receiving. So we do the division, and we find that equals $2,000. So what we can say is a total of $2,315 received 3 years from now at 5% is worth $2,000 today. Okay, any questions on that? Do a star 6 to unmute if you have a question. All right, hearing nothing, I'm going to move on to the next slide. And now we get into net present value. And with net present value, we use the future value of money, of the discounted cash flow, thing that we just finished, and we build a table. Because what we have to do is, for each one of the periods, we have a separate row in the table. So let's work down through this. So net present value allows you to calculate an expected cash flow in today's dollars, just like the future value did, or present value did, but now we're going to net it, because now we're going to be having inflows of cash or savings, so either revenue or savings, in every period. That first example I gave you, there was nothing in years 1 and 2; it all occurred in year 3. Okay, now in this example, we're going to be having inflows in each year, in each period. So you have to build the table, because you have to look at each period separately. Okay, so with NPV, we're going to evaluate the cash flows using whatever the discount is, and you always keep the same interest rate or discount rate for each of the rows in your table. So we're going to calculate those and develop multiple totals, and then we're going to sum those all together, and then come up with our net present value. So net present value assumes that all these cash flows are reinvented at the cost of capital, as I mentioned. So it's all going to be the same interest rate. You don't use a different interest rate. So let's look at the project selection rule that goes along with this. If you are using net present value, and almost every single project selection group, if you will, the body doing project selection will want to know the net present value and its follow-on IRR, which we'll talk about in the next slide. But you'll use net present value initially to determine whether a project is viable or not. I mean, you're going to see how that is how it's viable in a moment. So let's work down through the two tables that you see there. We've got two projects that we're considering working on, and we have to know which one if both of these projects are financially viable. So what we need to do is form the table that we see here. With Project A, we know that we have cash inflows of $10,000 in the first year. We have $15,000 in the second year and $5,000 in the third year. You see that in that middle column in the Project A table there. And you'll get those numbers from whatever the scenario in the exam provides for you. You know, you may have to read through it and figure it out, but eventually you're going to come to some revenue figure or some savings figure for each of those 3 years, and it'll tell you it's a 3-year project. And then what you have to do is the present value formula for each of those years. So for the year 1 row in Project A, that's going to be $10,000 divided by 1, and we see the interest rate is 12% in the left-hand side. So it's $10,000 divided by 1.12 times 1.12, and that's it. Just one time with the 1.12. Okay, so $10,000 divided by 1.12, and that equals 8,929. There'll be some sense there too, but I'm rounding to save space here. In year two, you know the inflow is $15,000. So you're going to do $15,000 over 1.12 times 1.12, because that's 2 years. You have to do two of the 1.12s. And once you do the division, you see that's 11,598. In year three, it's the same thing, or a similar thing. It's $5,000 over 1.12 times 1.12 times 1.12, because it's the third year. And if heaven forbid they have you go into 5 years, year four and year five are calculated the same way. You're just adding another 1.12 element to the divisor. Okay, and then you're going to add two more rows to the table, and then you'll be able to do the totals. So basically, once you finally get to the total row, we see for Project A, it's a $30,000. The inflow, but we can't look at it that way. We have to add up the next column, which is present value. So you add up all of those present values, and we see that the total present value is $24,446. Okay, now from the scenario, you will have found that the investment or the development cost for whatever this project is $24,000. And you'll find it buried someplace in the scenario, although it'd be nice and tell you what it is. So now you subtract it out. And you have 24,446 minus 24,000. So what you have left is a positive $446. And that $446 is the net present value for Project A. And that's a metric you need to pay attention to, and I'll tell you why in a moment. Let's look at Project B. For Project B, we're going at the same three-year time span. We see different sets of inflows per year, but it totals the same $30,000, which doesn't mean they're equal by any means because the inflows are very different. So we do the same scenario for year one. It's $7,000 divided by 1.12, and you see $6,250. For year two, we see $13,000 there, so it's $13,000 over 1.12 times 1.12 because it's 2 years, and do that division, and we see it's 10,364. And then finally, for the third year, we see that inflow is $10,000, and we know we're in the third year, so it's $10,000 over 1.12 times 1.12 times 1.12. You're doing all this on your scrap paper, you do the division, and we find that $7,118. And again, we do all the totals, and we find that this total winds up being $23,732. We know the initial investment is $24,000, because we got that from the scenario. It doesn't have to be the same as well as Project A, but in this case it is. And we do that subtraction, and we see a negative. $23,732 minus $24,000 is a negative $268. So there's a negative net present value. That's what those angle brackets mean. You can stick a minus sign in there. You can put parentheses, whatever you'd like. But you have to note that it is less than zero. And that's very important, because what this says is this project does not make back the initial investment. And that's very important, because unless you're in a social organization or have some sort of social need, or the CEO's pet project, you most likely will never invest in a project with a negative net present value. So let's look at the bullets down below the tables, and we see the Project A's net present value is greater than zero, and we say it could be accepted. Now, could is bolded, because now we have to consider any other project. I've given you two examples here, but say there's a dozen different projects that are being compared here. Because Project A has a positive net present value, you could consider that against any other of the projects that also have a positive net present value. Where Project B's net present value is less than zero, it's negative, you should reject that project outright, and it should not go any further than that. You know, and unless you've got a situation where it's the CEO's pet project or something else, and you have to do it for one reason or another, even though you're going to lose money, but that is that's an extra consideration that most projects don't receive. Most of the time, if a net present value for a project is less than zero, it's negative, you don't bother considering it at all. It dies right there. Or you go rework your numbers and hope you can do better next time. But the project will die a death, a horrible death, with a negative net present value. Okay? And then, let's see, another note on net present value calculations. Projects with high returns early in the project are better than projects with low returns early in the project. So project A fits this criteria. You notice the inflows in project A are in the early years are higher than the inflows in project B. Just for grins, if project B, if project B would have had a positive net present value, and maybe it came close, and maybe it was 400 instead of 446, then you might want to consider a project with a higher early year inflow, so you get your money back faster. But you don't necessarily have to. The point of that bullet there is look at some of the other things. If you're comparing all the other projects with a positive net present value and you're not sure which one to choose, you want to grab the ones with the higher numbers earlier in the project than some of the other ones. All right. And then when you're comparing two projects with positive net present value, 9 times out of 10, whoever has the higher net present value is the winner for that particular metric. So if you have a dozen projects and maybe six of them have negative net present value, so they drop off the plate, or probably better yet, never even submitted to the steering committee or the strategic committee or the project management office, whatever you happen to have in your organization, because they had a net present value. They don't even get submitted. So if you have a dozen projects you are submitting and you've run your numbers, then whoever has the highest net present value is going to be the winner, and they'll probably be one of the ones chosen, depending on the investment cost, obviously. But all other things being equal, the higher net present value wins. Now, I've seen in a lot of organizations, and I think I get to it on another slide as well, you know, they may have hurdle rates that even though your project might have a positive net present value, there may be some other considerations that we'll be paying attention to. So let's move on to the next slide, and we'll talk about that, because that thing is called internal rate of return. And what internal rate of return is on slide 19, it's another type of discounted cash flow. And the internal rate of return is the interest of the discount rate when the net present value of the cash inflows equals the original investment. Or what interest rate do you have to have for net present value to be zero? If you look back on slide 18, you see 5% that we use, or 12% that we use there. We only hit our positive project A was $440. So what interest rate would we have to use in order for that $440 to disappear? It goes to zero. You know, it's going to be something higher than 12%. Maybe it's only 13 or 14% and it's not 20. Excuse me. And that's what we're trying to figure out now. So that's how that whole thing works. It's a complicated formula. You'll have to have a financial calculator to do it, or a computer using a spreadsheet. It can be done manually, but it's tedious. So for the test, they'll probably tell you what the IRR is for a bunch of projects and ask you some project selection methods. What they'll probably do is give you a table like what I'm going to show you in a moment and ask you to pick which project is the most viable one to choose. But trying to calculate an IRR is beyond the scope of the exam, so you don't have to worry too much about it, but you really have to pay attention to the fact that the internal rate of return is the interest rate at which NPV is zero. And a lot of companies use IRR as what we call a hurdle rate. And I'll get to that in a moment. So look at the exam facts down here that you see. IRR, as I mentioned, is the discount rate when NPV equals zero. IRR assumes that the cash flows are reinvested at the same rate for every single period. If you've got a three-year period you were talking about, or a five-year period, the interest rate, the discount rate, doesn't change over those years. It's always going to be the same. And that being said, and all other things being equal, you would always want to choose projects with the highest IRR value. A project with a 15% IRR is a better project financially than a project with a 5% IRR, is the way that works. And if any of you have gone off and actually bought the fifth edition of the Heldman book, you can look on page 65 in an example or case study called Fun Days Vacation Resorts. And there you see payback beats IRR. I put that in there because IRR isn't... as you work through things, there are sometimes some companies choose a higher weight for a different metric. So let's move to the next slide and talk about that. So what do you do with all these things? How do you put these all together to make sure that you're applying the right set of logic in order to choose the right project? Your strategic planning guidelines, or your steering committee guidelines, are going to tell you what to do. In previous lives, I was a product manager where I had a product that I was promoting, and I had to do all my financials. I knew that I had to meet at least a 15% IRR for my project. And if I didn't have at least 15%, I was never going to submit it anywhere because I knew they wouldn't approve it. So as you work through within your specific organization, they're going to set forth whatever the things they are paying attention to. If they have to have a 15% IRR, just the fact that they have an IRR that is positive always will tell you that net present value is positive. And that's why in the table you see in the middle of this slide, you don't see net present value. Why? Because I've always got a positive IRR. A positive IRR always means there's a positive net present value. Okay, but in some cases, payback may be more important. So your steering committee, your strategic committee is going to tell you what hurdles you have to go over. And using numbers from that the thing from the Heldman book, that page 65 in the Heldman book, these are the numbers from there, it'll tell you what you want to follow. So, excuse me, in the book, in the test, I should say, if they tell you payback period is the primary metric we want to use. To select projects, and you've got three projects, A, B, and C there. You look at the table where project A has a payback period of 5 years, project B has a payback period of 3.5 years, project C has a payback period of 2 years. And I'll read off the IRR column as well for those who don't have the slides in front of them. And if you're driving, please don't wrap yourself around a telephone pole trying to write these things down. But the IRR for Project A is 8%, Project B is 3%, and Project C is 3%. So we have the same IRR for two of the projects at 3%, and IRR is 8 for Project A. Now, and the bullet there is, as I mentioned, since IRR is positive, we already know the net present value is going to be positive. So if the scenario that your exam has or that your company has is they care more about payback period than they do IRR, then you would pick Project C. I'm going to pause. If anyone have a question on that, I'll do a *6 to unmute your phone. If you have a question to see that the payback period of 2 years pays back faster, so you would pick Project C. Because the payback period is less, if that is the most important criteria for your organization. All right, hearing nothing, I'll carry on. Now, there are going to be other companies that IRR is more important and payback period is not. So in that scenario, if IRR is more important, with a project A with an IRR of 8% is higher than the other two projects of 3%, you would pick Project A over the other two, because it has a higher internal rate of return at 8%. And if there was some money left over, you select Project A, and there's money left over to do something else, now you're picking between Projects B and C, there's where you maybe do multiple criteria, because the IRR of Projects B and C are both 3. In that case, you'd probably choose Project C with a payback period of 2 years over Project B with a payback period of 3.5 years, because Project C pays back faster. So you can mix and match the metrics is the whole point of this example here. Any questions on any of that? Okay, so bottom bullet there is make sure that you understand from the scenario on the exam what order they're applying things. Is it IRR first and then payback? IRR first and then, or payback first and IRR. You should always calculate the net present value as well if the question calls for it and use net present value. But remember, anything with a high IRR is also going to have a high net present value. So they're sort of mutually exclusive, but you probably want to calculate it anyway, since you're not going to be asked to calculate an IRR because it's too difficult. But you can do the net present values. So maybe on the test, your version of the test, they won't give you IRRs; they'll give you net present values, and ask you to do the same thing. If I were to have columns there for net present value instead of IRR, we'll make up some numbers. Maybe the net present value was say 800 for project A, and maybe 300 for both project B and project C. You make them equal, and then you could run the same test question that way as well. You'd want to pick the project with the higher net present value first. And then if you have money left over, what do you pick second? Well, if the net present values are the same at 300, then you'd want to pick a project that has a shorter payback period. So the scenario winds up being exactly the same thing. You pick project C because it pays back in 2 years as opposed to 3.5 years for project B. So whatever those order and values are, you make sure you apply them appropriately, because the test, guaranteed, the test is going to give you answers that are wrong, but the numbers are right. It's going to say, well, you should pick project B first because project C first because it has a low payback. But when they really told you IRR is more important or net present value is more important, so project C will definitely be one of the answers. So you have to make sure that you don't choose project C, because while it's certainly something that you can pick, it's not the right answer.
Dan?
Yes, sir.
Bart, would an organization just be that straightforward of saying IRR is the preferred choice, or would it be more of a complex thing like, well, if you don't have any IRRs over 15, then let's kind of go with the lower payback period, sort of mark time, so that maybe 2 years from now, in this example, mm-hmm. We might have another project opportunity that is 17 IRR, when we want to jump on that.
Yeah, from what I've seen, most organizations, there's enough projects around that if they have a standard 15% IRR, someone's going to come up with something that's going to beat it. Because there's going to be some industrious product manager out there who's going to work their numbers accordingly and grab the money. Although your scenario could certainly play out, and that, well, we're not going to invest in anything this year, we're going to wait. But a lot of times, if the cash is there, they may want to use the cash right now and not squirrel it away somewhere for next year, because it's going to potentially cost them money to keep it someplace. So they want to, because they're going to hope that by investing in a project, if they know they're only going to get in this day and age, they're only going to get 5% for their money, they want to invest in a project that has more than 5% IRR, because that's like interest rates coming in, if you will. So chances are, what they're going to do is they come up with some other projects that beat our hurdle rate, and if the times are tough, maybe the hurdle rate isn't 15%, maybe the hurdle rate is only 5%, or it's 10%, or 8%. The hurdle rate is totally arbitrary. To a great extent, it's probably based on their cost of capital. So I'm sure if their cost of capital, will make up more numbers. It's 15%. They're not going to set the hurdle rate down at 2%, because they're losing money with any investment they do in a project. They're going to want to set their hurdle rate at something higher than whatever their cost of capital is, which is another exam question, by the way, now that I've said the term cost of capital. They may tell you the cost of capital is 12%. Well, that's your interest rate, folks. That's what you're going to use, is 12%. They may not call it discount rate. They may not call it interest rate. They'll call it cost of capital. So, Bart, thank you for that question, because you just brought up something else that could appear on the test.
Okay, good. I understand it better, too, so thanks for that explanation.
Not a problem. It's going to vary. Most organizations will say, here's what we want. There are some that may be a bit more, I don't want to call them wishy-washy, but maybe not as succinct as others. I know when I was a product manager, I knew what my hurdle rate was, and there wasn't any way I was going to be able to bring a project forward if it had an IRR of less than 15%. And so we worked our numbers such that we had more than 15%. We had to either decrease our development costs or increase revenue somehow. There's something to make the IRR go over the hurdle rate. And then the same with payback period. When you start messing with those development costs and the cash flows, that's going to affect your payback period too. So any product manager worth their salt, a project manager worth their salt, is going to know how to do the manipulations. Excuse me, they'll know how to do the manipulations so that they can achieve the metrics that they're looking for. And on the test, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to develop, if you're lucky, they're just going to give you a table with four, five, or six projects in it, tell you the numbers, and say, here are the criterion that the John Smith Company wants. Which project are you going to do? Or projects are you going to do? Maybe they're going to give you a bucket of money, or maybe they're just going to say, which one project would you choose? They might force you to, if you had this list of projects, you know, you have, let's say, $1 million, and you've got a collection of projects whose development costs are well less than $1 million. How many projects are you going to pick in order to consume that $1 million of money, available money? And maybe you'll get to pick two or three projects, and the answers are going to be, you know, project one only, project A only, projects B and D is the B choice answer. The C choice answer is projects F and Q or something along those lines, and the D answer is all or none or something along those lines. And you'll have to pick and choose which one is the correct answer based on whatever the scenario is. You got to pay real close attention to the scenario, and you know when scenarios are going to give you a whole lot of information, some of which you're not going to need. So remember, they often give you extra information in the scenarios, so that you have to pay attention to what you pick and choose. Okay, that's the end of the presentation tonight. Are there any other project selection method questions out there with the interactive bunch that we have on here tonight? If you need to do a *6 to unmute your phone, please do, because I muted everybody's phone when we started. Bart figured out how to unmute his phone. So anybody else, if you have a question, a *6 will unmute you, and I'll entertain any other project selection questions. All right, hearing nothing. Any other questions in general about the PMP exam or the study process or PM lessons learned for that matter as well? Yeah, go ahead, Bart.
I did have a question before, and I couldn't figure out how to unmute my phone in time. you mentioned with the payback period.
Mm-hmm.
You don't worry about present value, future value.
Correct.
You're just looking to pay back the amount. That's not 100% logical to me.
Yeah, it's not. That's the theoretic. That's historically a better way to say it. The way payback period is done, because if you start doing the discounted cash flows, that winds up being net present value. And once you apply discounted cash flows, you're back at net present value. So payback period does not discount the cash flows. It's just whatever I'll call the ordinal value of the cash flow is. It does seem a little counterintuitive, but when you think about it, as soon as you apply time value of money, the discounted cash flows, what you have left is net present value. So and the intent of payback period is basically just to see roughly how quickly a project is going to pay back. It's a real rough measurement. I don't think there are very many companies that just use payback in a period in order to select a project. They're all going to be sophisticated enough that they're going to use multiple methods. Now, the test, that's another story. The exam could say, we're only going to use payback, and it's perfectly viable to do that. You won't see that in most companies you deal with, but for an exam, why not?
Yeah, okay. I guess I'm not looking at it at this moment as for the exam because I'm trying to think how it applies in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. Like you say, maybe it's just, okay, just to do some quick thoughts, you know, this works for me.
Yeah, and it's certainly real companies aren't going to do that. If you're a project manager or a product manager, you know, everybody does payback period as one of the standard metrics. They may not pay attention to it, but it's easy to do. So why not include it? And a lot of companies will require you to do it anyway. They'll probably ask you for all three. They'll ask you for payback period, they'll ask you for net present value, and they'll ask you for IRR because they want to see the numbers. And people on the selection committees may or may not be aware that net present value and IRR are kind of the same thing. A positive net present value is a positive IRR, and a negative net present value is a negative IRR, and they're all sort of there's a linear relationship is what I'm trying to say. A high net present value will yield a high RRR. Then something that is a lesser negative, a lesser net present value will yield a lesser IRR. So you can use either or on net present value and IRR, but a lot of companies will have you do both. For the test, you could wind up doing both as well, but you're not going to have to calculate IRR for the test. They'll just give it to you. But you will have to calculate net present value unless you get an exam that has a gift in it and they tell you what the net present values are. I know mine certainly didn't have any gifts in it around there. I had to calculate all my net present values.
Okay. And I had another question going back to, I guess, slide 8 with the feasibility study.
Okay.
And the group of people conducting the feasibility study should not be the same people who will work on the project. Now, I can kind of see why, because they're going to prove, yeah, it's worth it because I want to have a job and do it.
Sure. Yeah, right. Exactly right. Or the other way around. Perhaps it's something they really, really, really don't want to do. So they're going to do whatever they can to shoot the project down. But the point is there's a bias in either direction there that you have to deal with. So you're going to do a feasibility study, grab some other people who are not going to be the project people. And a lot of time, feasibility studies are done by the marketeers. The marketing folks are the ones that are out there looking to see what the company can do for projects, and they'll come up with the ideas, and maybe they'll do the feasibility study and do a rough set of numbers. And that's fine because it's the marketeers who are I'll call them unbiased. You know, they want to do things that will make money, but they're going to come up with a ton of different things, done a ton of different ideas for projects, and some of those may be pet projects, so they'll slant the numbers a bit higher than some others. But the marketeers are certainly not going to be the developers of whatever the project is. So you're producing a product, a widget of some kind. They're not going to be the developers. They're just the marketeers. So marketeers tend to be a very, very good set of folks to do the feasibility studies. Now, I don't know if you'll see that in a test or not. I don't think so, but you could. The point is you want to make sure that it's not the same folks that are doing the development.
Okay, but the people this is what I guess is the point that I just got in my head. The people conducting it should not be the same people, but they'll probably be talking to people who will actually be working on the project.
Oh, sure. Yeah, they can certainly do that, right, because there may be some technical things going on. Well, is this here's a real good thing we need to do, but is it technically feasible? They might have to talk to a development person to see if the company has the right technology or right infrastructure or the right whatever is operating in the right legal circles or whatever the case may be to produce the project. So there certainly can be influences from development people to make sure things work out. But it's only here and there, or it's not. They're not doing the actual full study. They're just providing data, if you will.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's it. That was my little problem of, you know, some of the people who actually have to work on this because they're the technical people.
Right.
should be involved in the feasibility study, but the word conducting it is those people, yeah, they'll give answers to the people conducting, but have no decision making
mm-hmm.
of it. But the people can. Okay, I got it. Thanks.
All right. Any other questions out there from anybody? Okay, so no other questions. Let me do my outro, and then I'll stop the recording, and then we'll see if there's anything else going on here.
Dana, this is Chuck. I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Chuck.
Real quick question. I heard from a couple of people who took the version 4 test recently that there were questions that were beyond what you would think there would be. In other words, they were indicating that there were questions from tests from things that came in the appendices, where they literally were asking, version 3 says blah, 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 version 4 says this, and you had to know that there was a difference in that section, you know, and the person said that they recommended reading all of the Pinbach book, including all the differences between version 3 and 4, that they went to that minutia on the version of the test that they had.
Mm.
So when I heard that, I was like, here I am trying to concentrate on the, you know, basically what you see on page 43 in the main areas, the framework and all that, and then that goes all thrown in. So just to let everybody know, just at least be familiar with the back parts of it and be aware that there are, you know, there are some changes and kind of know, I think one of the ones that sticks in my mind, it has to do with like the, it was the ADO or on nodes or whatever.
Oh, yeah, right. That's in scheduling, the activity on arrow and activity on node, correct.
They got rid of that in version 4. So,
right.
You just, those types of things.
Right.
So just, you know, I wouldn't like spend my life knowing it, but just at some point in your study, take a look.
Yeah, you are the first one who's mentioned anything about that. No one had said to me, oh, by the way,
somebody took the test 2 weeks ago, so I would say just be aware of it.
Ah, interesting. Interesting.
Okay. All right.
Thanks for that, Chuck. Appreciate that. That's always good to have that level of intelligence going in and what's on the test. So,
okay.
Anything else anybody told you about the test?
Yes. The other thing she told us about was there was a lot of scenarios. In other words, it's nice to know these formulas the way we went through them tonight. But
mm-hmm.
a lot of it had to do with having an understanding of where the formulas lie. In
right.
other words, tonight's formulas, you know, all have to do with initial project selection. There's a whole bunch of other formulas, earned value management, probabilities, different types of things. And a lot of it was, in the course of the question, understanding, you know, where are you in the course of this project and knowing the formula that lies in that area. Not so much knowing how to use the formula or even calculating the formula, but being aware of in that section, these are the formulas that you would use.
Sure, sure, that makes sense. And for that, folks, if you haven't already done so, go back to the PM Lessons Learned Yahoo group and grab my brain dump. There's a version 4 brain dump, but I think an early September date on it. And it has all the rest of those formulas that Chuck is talking about. And it doesn't tell you where to apply them, but at least tells you how to do them and such, so that you'll know all those as well.
The suggestion I have from our weekly group, and I think we have something I could put out on the monthly group, was the grid on page, and I go back to the grid on page 43.
Mm-hmm.
It was like you lay out all the areas. It's having all the formulas at your fingertips and then knowing where it lies in the different knowledge areas and the processing groups and actually having the formulas plotted around that whole grid. So in addition to brain dumping everything else, it's also knowing where you are. So however you can remember it.
Great point.
Okay.
Thanks for that.
That's it.
Anything else from anybody?
Those are the major ones.
Okay, beautiful. Anything else from anyone else? All right, let me get into my outro here, and then I'll stop the recording, and then we'll talk about anything else anybody has.
Hello.
Yep, you have a question? Yep, go ahead.
Yes, yes, sir. I just want to ask, what are the major differences between version 3 and version 4, specifically on which chapters? Because I know there's a major changes on procurement. Any other chapters which we have major changes? Because I found a lot of study material in PM Lesson Learned, which are version 3, but we can use for version 4 also, except for those there are major changes.
Right. As I mentioned in the introduction to the call, there's about a 30% difference between version 3 and version 4, and it's pretty much all in the processes. The number of processes change, and the inputs, the outputs, and the tools and techniques have changed. The things like the formulas and whatever have not changed. So what you have to pay attention to between version 3 and version 4 are mostly the processes. And Chuck mentioned earlier one of the other ones, in that version 4 has basically dropped the activity on arrow, or a method of diagramming, which is also used by many governments for PERT technique, Project Evaluation Review technique. Those are not in there so much anymore, as well as these project selection techniques. They were part of scope back in version 3. They're now part of chapter 2, which is not even part of the processes. Which is why I went over them tonight, because they're not ingrained in any specific process anymore like they were in version 3. I'll be doing the same thing for organizational management as well, because organizational management was embedded in the scope planning as well, because depending upon your organization, how your organization is structured, you'll have either an easy or a difficult time in doing your project management. So paying attention to version 3 is okay to do, but you have to be very careful when you're studying the processes. Make sure you use only the version 4 stuff so that you're not confused. As far as PM Lessons Learned goes, anything that I've done since June of 2009 is definitely 100% version 4. So anything you pull out of the past monthly study group folder that has a June date and forward is totally version 4. You don't have to worry about how to apply it, because it's all germane. Or anything prior to June, you've got to pay attention to what some of the differences are. And there's even a differences presentation in there as well, so you can see what the differences are.
Because you found a lot of material on internet for version 3 only, so it's very difficult to get version 4.
Well, you got version 4 is tougher to find. It's getting easier as time goes on, but there are still people who are actually selling and taking folks' money for version 3 material, which I think is not very ethical at all. But they're doing it. So if you're going to buy something on the internet, make sure that it's totally applicable to version 4. That's why I give you the ISBN number of the study guide that I've taken this information from, because I know that is definitely version 4, and that's why I told you use stuff from PM Lessons Learned dated June of 2009 and beyond, because that is also guaranteed to be 2004. I mean, to be PMBOK version 4 related, but there's still some things from the earlier slides that might be usable by you. But you got to be careful. Any other questions?
No, because I scheduled my exam on the third week of December. I have a very short term left, so I just want to concentrate on the right material.
Right. Yeah. Focus on version 4 as much as you can. Let me get through the outro here, and we can talk a little bit more about some of those things for you, since you're going to be testing in a couple of weeks here. So let me spend 2 minutes on my outro, and then we'll talk some more here. So for the outro, for those unaware, the PM Lessons Learned conducts 3 conference calls each month. This virtual PMP study group call that we are on now occurs on the first Thursday of each month. On the second Thursday of each month, we have our PM Lessons Learned Job Shop call, where folks in transition with a need to identify potential career paths can work together to help each other. And finally, on the third Thursday of each month, we hold a PM Lessons Learned conference call, where we provide a variety of project management and soft skill topics. So, okay, that's it for this session of the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP study group call. Again, I'll thank the live participants on this conference call and everybody that downloads the podcast. Speaking of the podcast, I've just found out that over the past year that I've been doing these sessions, you folks have downloaded over 6,000 times. So I really appreciate your support for these downloads. Okay, so I'll remind you that we are PMLessonsLearned.com, project managers helping project managers to make a difference. My name is Dana Safford. So long, and keep on learning.
This has been a PM Lessons Learned podcast. Project managers helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Come join our group. Visit our website at PMLessonsLearned.com. Till next time, keep on learning.